Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
Fun fact, when I was in college, I grew my own alfalfa sprouts. Because that was a thing people did back then.
Yeah.
Growing stuff is fun.
Yeah. It was a crunchy granola period
in
my life.
I'm just imagining Scott as a crunchy granola hippie.
This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Today on The Breakdown, 2024 is shaping up to be a very mixed bag for women in politics. On the one hand, California is heading toward having no female representation in the U.S. Senate for the first time since 1992, when the late Dianne Feinstein became the first woman to ever represent the Golden State in the Senate.
In 1992, it became the year of the woman, because both Barbara Boxer and I were elected from California, two women from Washington, and two women from Maine. And we broke the lock on power for women in the Senate.
But this year, a number of women House members are being replaced by men. At the same time, though, record numbers of women will be representing their districts in the state legislature. Our guest today is Susanna Delano, head of Close the Gap, which helps elect more women to all levels of government.
You know, women candidates face a lot of obstacles most men don't: raising money, balancing home life with the 24/7 nature of running for office, and having to travel back to your district in California as a member of Congress.
No small matter. But Susanna Delano from Close the Gap, welcome to Political Breakdown. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Happy to have you.
Hopefully not last time.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, here we are in 2024. Tell us, why does it matter if there are more women in Congress, in the state legislature?
Well, women bring so much to the table, and I think clearly a majority of Californians value reflective representation and understand that there's perspective that's missing from the table if women aren't there. But I think, you know, in the wake of the most recent results, it's clear that it's the end of an era. Titans have fallen. The era is done. Many women were not recruited to be successors in those places. So that much is clear.
I mean, we mentioned at the top, though, that we are losing an honor that California has held, for, you know, this mantle for decades of two women in the U.S. Senate, the last few years, just one. I mean, from your perspective, like, what would you say to someone who says a progressive pro-choice man, an Adam Schiff, would vote the same as a Dianne Feinstein? So what does it matter?
I think that's the goal, and we're absolutely working towards that. I think one of the reasons that I'm motivated to do this work is the hope that a more fully reflective set of elected officials will really shift the way that politics works in general and shift the priorities. But I think the reality is the patriarchy is alive and well, and are so many other systems of power. And women really bring a nuanced approach to politics that we need. And I think the appetite that Americans have right now for a pretty dramatic scale of change is there.
Give us an example of an issue or an argument,
policy,
policy where having a woman at the table has made a difference or would have made a difference.
Absolutely. Well, I think if you look at the history of California women in the legislature, certainly reproductive health, we really have the gold standard as far as a reimbursement system for that that actually works. And then in recent years, you know, with the Women's Caucus partnering with the Future of Abortion Council, passing that historic package of bills has raised the bar even further. And that's really important to our national outlook on that front, as well as our ability to be a true a safe haven for women from other states.
So I know, kind of back to the Senate race, we saw two women, Barbara Lee and Katie Porter, come in third and fourth. And we didn't see groups like Emily's List step in to help either woman. Do you think that was the right call? Like, should more have been done?
Well, it's not for me to say what those organizations' call should have been. But I think in general, what I can say is at Close the Gap, we've definitely seen this moment coming in terms of a decline. And in a lot of ways, it's a decline for women's representation. It's a delayed reflection in many ways of women's decline in the state legislature, which we've been working on for a decade. And there's really good news to share there. Yeah. And that's one reason I was so happy to join you all today, was to talk more about that, because I think that's really building towards more than just one wave election. It's really becoming a sustained wave that's going to change the bench for decades to come.
Yeah, well, say more about that. Like, what is the situation up in Sacramento? Why is it changing now?
Yeah, so women's representation will have more than doubled since 2017 by the end of this year.
Wow.
Which is like more than the price of groceries has grown in a similar time period. So that's really eye-popping to make that tangible for your listeners. And I think it's a lot of things. I think 2022 and 2024 are really different animals when you start to see this sustained volume of growth. And it's really building towards a wave of women that is far more racially diverse, more diverse in terms of sexual orientation. It does skew heavily progressive, majority women of color. Those are all really important features of California's delegation that will ultimately go to the national stage.
I mean, your group's stated goal is to recruit and prepare diverse progressive women to run for open and winnable seats. And you define progressive as pro-choice, pro-public education, anti-poverty. Mm-hmm. And yet, obviously, you include Republican women and others when you talk about these data points. How does it matter? I mean, maybe to go against your mission a little bit, to have women on sort of at all parts of the political spectrum in those seats.
I think it does matter. And, you know, little known fact, there was a predecessor entity to Close the Gap that actually worked on a bipartisan basis. It had more of a national lens.
Did that change?
Did the scope change?
Yeah, the mission.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our Close the Gap's founder, Mary Hughes, partnered with a number of academics at the time. And, you know, the decision was that a much finer scope in terms of one body that was very significant to the national outlook, which is the California State Legislature, in terms of the cutting edge policies it can send forward, was the venue to do that. And frankly, you know, it's easier to coalesce communities of common interest when you have a values lens, and that was important to the whole founding group, as well as the rest of us. So, yeah.
Has that changed, too? Do you think even more so with things like Dobbs coming down? Because it does feel like we're more polarized and there's sort of less room for that
Absolutely. Reaching
across the aisle.
Yes.
Yeah.
California is one of the few states that has not had, well, I shouldn't say one of the few, but there are many states that have had female governors. You know, we never have. There are several running in 2026.
Yep.
What do you make of that? Like, why has that not happened here, given that so many states, and now a lot of states have two women senators as well?
Yeah. Well, I did say on the record that the patriarchy is alive and well, and I think you can see that across a number of fronts. And it is shifting, though. I mean, you asked why. I think it's actually possible we'll see gender parity in the legislature the same year that we see the first woman governor. So it is beginning to shift. But, you know, every woman that runs in our electoral system is running against really strong headwinds. It's you know, that much more difficult to get to that point.
Say more about that, though. Like, is that because it's hard on a personal level or like more of a societal level? Like, we talk a lot with Barbara Lee about the, you know, challenges of a Black woman raising money. Like, is it both things?
I think it's both. It's absolutely both. It's certainly experienced on a personal level. There's been a lot of new studies just this year. I'm on an advisory board for the Brennan Center at NYU Law Center that just studied the rise in threats and harassment, particularly against women of color. And we see, I think, you know, that is very much alive.
And women also tend to do more at home, right?
Absolutely. A lot of us are the sandwich generation. You know, we're caregiving for one generation behind and one ahead. There's a fuller plate in that way. But I do think it's fundamentally systemic. The system was not built for us. And that's one thing, you know, when I'm coaching women who are exploring a run for the state legislature in a couple years down the road, oftentimes I'll start out by saying, hey, we live in a patriarchy, we live in a white supremacist system, we live in a heteronormative world. And if you're someone who doesn't think about those things, or if you're someone who confronts them daily, either way, I guarantee you're going to run into them on the trail and you need to get ready.
And just why then why are more women getting elected given all those headwinds?
Yeah, well, the simplest answer is because more women are running. We've known for a long time that when women run, they win just as often as men, even if they're working 3-4 times as hard to get there. So Close the Gap's approach has really been about a volume approach. Going back just a few election cycles, women were barely 30% of candidates for state legislature. Mm-hmm. Now they're approaching 50%. I'd be happier if it was more like 70%. But, you know, in 2024, we saw 135 women run for state legislative positions, and that is a 40% increase over just 2018. So it's really growing. And again, it's majority women of color, and it's up and down the state.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and we'll continue our conversation. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. We will be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. We're talking with Susanna Delano. She's executive director of Close the Gap, which helps women run for and get elected to public office. We're talking before the break about, the pipeline of women sounds very strong. Is that, do you think, because in part because, you know, women like Pelosi, for example, Nancy Pelosi waited till her kids were a little older, you know, before they ran? I mean, is that part of what's happening? Or is it just that women are getting involved in more aspects of everything, you know, from business, although that's been lagging, to other aspects of, you know, life, nursing, teaching, and so on, and they are now deciding to run for office?
I do think more women are seeing themselves in office. I think this moment has roots in a backlash. After coming out of the 2016 election, we've definitely seen a lot more women self-nominating. There's always a degree, you know, in the work I do of when you see someone doing the job, you think, oh, I could do that. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely taken off, I think. But fundamentally, I think that there were seeds planted in California over 20 years ago to get to this moment now. And it's taken a lot of groups. You know, Close the Gap is one, but we're part of a greater ecosystem. You know, Emerge was founded in California 20 plus years ago. Close the Gap 10 years ago. Around the same time, California Women's List, a PAC that is increasingly active. A lot of leadership trainings and Fund Her, a new PAC in the wake of 2016. What I see from my perspective is all of those groups really coalescing around a determination to not see this continued glacial pace of progress, that if we're united, if the women are funded, if all of our groups are funded, we're going to be able to effectuate the sea change that we're seeing play out.
Can you talk about what the process looks like? I mean, you mentioned a little bit of it, but you guys have like a 2-year process. And I guess to start with, like, how do you even identify somebody who's potentially a recruit? And then what happens over that 2 years?
Yeah. So I always tell new staff members, this is an art, not a science. And it definitely is. And it's very much rooted in organizing and allyship. We start out with the district itself, which is one thing that I think distinguishes Close the Gap. We're very targeted. We're only looking at open seats in the state legislature or flippable Republican-held seats. And we start with list building. It's at the heart of so much of politics is building a list just through research.
A list of, like, potential
allies,
candidates.
Potential women, yeah.
And what do you, like, what do you look for? Yeah. What makes a good potential candidate?
So I'll give you an example. Cecilia Aguiar-Curry, our majority leader today, my predecessors at Close the Gap, started reading about her because she had won a big award at the county fair, I think it was, in Yolo County.
Wow.
She had brought in a bunch of resources, internet for her town. She was clearly leading the small city council that she was serving on at the time. So our team approached her and sat down to coffee and said, you know, we'd see this assembly seat coming open. We know there's a couple guys already lining up, as they always are. We think you would have a really decent shot. And she slammed her fist down on the table and said, I have been waiting for someone to ask me.
And that's so typical of women, right? Yeah. They wait to be asked, men are like, I'll do it, which is part of the problem.
That's often repeated. But, you know, what the data shows is that it's not just asking, it's also having a guide at that point. And then that's, you know, to answer your question, Marisa, about our process, at the point when we get a think about that. We start to work with women one-on-one over the course of a year or more in a guided exploration, just making introductions, giving inspiration, giving them information. I would say in particular, we focus on the ways that running for state legislature is very different from running for local office. Mm. We talk about, you know, running the parallel campaign in Sacramento to win over and, you know.
Like the interest groups and the funders.
Absolutely.
And the people
third house world. Yeah.
We want to talk about success stories, but I'm curious, like, when have you seen women bow out of these programs? Because I'm thinking in particular of someone like LaFonza Butler. She ran Emily's List before. She was tapped by the governor to replace Dianne Feinstein. And after a few months, she decided not to run. Now, whatever situations was going on, I mean, it was a very short runway for her. But we also heard her talk about, you know, how hard it was, particularly as a Black lesbian mom, to suddenly be in this moment. They started getting threats, people showing up to her mother's house. Like, I just wonder, like, is that what you hear? What is it that turns women off if they're sort of willing to enter the process?
Those deterrents are very real. And I think the perception and the reality of a toxic culture in politics is fast becoming one of the top three barriers that we hear. Timing can be part of it. there are a number of barriers, but I do have to say for us at Close the Gap, we really think of it as a success when we go through a two-year exploration and the woman decides, no, this is not the right time. This is not the right thing for me. This is not going to fulfill me. You know,
do they ever come back later?
They do. They do. Hmm. Yeah.
You know, I know you like to focus on success stories, but I'm wondering what you learned from the losses. And I'm thinking in particular of Christy Smith, Democrat, who ran three times and lost three times to Mike Garcia. That was a seat held by a woman, who, Katie Hill, who stepped down from Congress, the special election. You know, and so now there's a man from NASA, George Whiteside, who's running. What do you learn? I mean, that must be excruciating to see somebody who you, helped, supported, wanted to win, see lose not once, not twice, but three times.
It is, absolutely. And I think there is sort of increasing interest and investment in resources for candidates who have run and not won in their first or second time out, just to make sure that those dreams don't,
turn to nightmares.
Go out. Yeah. Yeah, permanently. So we definitely take something from every loss. I think it teaches us about the institutions and the water that we're swimming in. I think disparities are very clear along gender and race lines when we look at investment in races like the one you mentioned. But there's a lot of nuance there. Every race is different, just like every potential candidate's different.
And candidates matter.
They do. Candidate quality is huge.
I mean, I wonder, talking about nuance, like, you have a very clear mission. You're going to support the woman that you guys helped train to run. But we've seen in other races, I mean, I mentioned Leanne Porter not getting the support of some of the, women, female-focused PACs. We saw a really knockdown, drag-out fight in actually Katie Porter's congressional seat between a sitting state senator, Dave Min, a local female attorney, Joanna Weiss. Do you think, like, women or groups that support them, like, have an obligation to support women in a race like that? Like, and how much should we be thinking about, like, who's more likely to actually win the congressional seat if you're coming from a Democratic perspective?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think anybody's under any obligation. I mean, I think folks need to develop a tolerance for women running against each other. I think women are more often unfairly cast as spoilers when they make the decision to run, whereas
or to
men
not
are
run, like Katie Porter. Why are you leaving this congressional seat?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, for Close the Gap, and I know many of our allies, it really is about the long game. And, when you look at the decline in women at the federal level, to go back to what we began talking about, the primary bench for our congressional delegation is the state legislature. Right. Half of them go on to serve in Congress, and 8 out of our 17 congresswomen first served in the state legislature. So, what happened? We had 92. It was great. By the mid-2000s, starting to decline. By the time we get to the 2010s, we hit a 20-year low in women's representation at the state legislature. Mm-hmm. So the bench broke, and it's on full display now. But the good news is we've put in a decade and then some building back.
Well, I want to ask about another member of the legislature who tried to win a congressional seat, and that is Senator Melissa Hurtado. Mm-hmm. And she jumped into a race against David Valadao in the 22nd congressional district in and around Bakersfield. She said later that Emily's List had encouraged her to run. And then Rudy Salas, the former assemblyman who narrowly lost to Valadao in 2022, got in. And there was a concern that the two of them were going to split the Democratic vote and leave two Republicans in the runoff. And there was a lot of money spent against her. What was your take on that? As you sat on, I don't know if you're, I assume you're on the sidelines, but maybe you were helping her. I don't know. Like, what happened there?
Yeah, I haven't talked to her this cycle, but, I was definitely anxious about that possibility as well. I think at the same time, to go back to what I said, women don't need to play by different rules just because they're women. I think, there's good reasons to run in every race. And, what I'm excited about on the congressional level is we've got Laura Luz and Latifah now in very good position to become California's newest congresswomen. And, to my point earlier, two of the three came from our state legislature and still serve today.
I mean, the Senate's smaller, but it does seem like we've seen a real sort of influx of not just women, but to your point, diverse women, younger women, women of color in the last few years, and kind of leapfrogging over the assembly where a lot of people get their start. Is that something sort of intentional that you guys have done?
No. If anything, you know, Senate races are harder to win. I think, you know, if you're an incumbent assemblywoman running for Senate, that's, you know, kind of the easiest way. But no, I don't know if it's because of leadership or what, but the Senate has outpaced the Assembly in gender representation for a long time. Women of color became the majority of women in the Senate back in 2020 when Susan Eggman and Monique Lemoine both won their elections to the Senate. So that's a point of pride, I think, and I think it's also a motivator for the Assembly.
You mentioned Laura, and I assume you were talking about Laura Friedman,
yes,
the Assemblywoman in Los Angeles who ran for Adam Schiff's seat and ran against, you know, some pretty stiff competition, including a state senator,
right,
Anthony Portantino, who had a lot of big labor support, and yet she came in first by quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think she prevailed there when women lost in other races?
I think her district knows her and loves her. I think she ran a good campaign. I think she, you know, her particular talents really align with some of the deepest felt needs in that district in terms of climate and transportation. You know, I was delighted to see the results. It was a really strong
outcome. Were you surprised?
For her. A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think not that she won, but that the margin was so impressive. But I do think it's a theme this year. I mean, you see, talking about the state Senate, you know, Rhodesia Ransom in her initial run in the Senate seat and then Assembly, and Sasha Renee Perez down in L.A., their early strength, I think, was really instrumental in a couple of the guys they were running against actually deciding to flip their target and shoot a little lower. So
that's fascinating. I want to ask you about Republican women. We've seen a lot of blowback this week to the GOP response to the State of the Union. Senator Katie Britt, youngest person in the Senate of any gender. First of all, she chose to do it in her kitchen, and then she's gotten some heat, including from the young woman she talked about, by essentially misrepresenting a story about a sex trafficking victim, claiming, or
sort of blaming it on Biden.
Sort of blaming it on Biden, even though it happened during George W. Bush's term, mm-hmm, and to a woman in Mexico who never made it to the U.S. But I don't know, just broadly, like, I think a lot of times we hear, you know, women are treated differently. There's different expectations. Do you feel like the response to her has been unfair?
No. Just from my gut, I think it was really dangerous in so many ways and fell so flat. And
What do you mean dangerous?
The misrepresentation of a sexual assault victim, not to mention, you know, lifting up a presidential candidate who is a convicted sexual assaulter. It was just really beyond the pale. And I, you know, the gender dynamics, whether she chose to do it in her kitchen, whether it was her kitchen or set.
Right? You know.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, if you imagine a male senator doing it from his garage workshop, you just don't see it. It's not professional. And I think it does speak to, you know, the GOP's aware that they have a weakness, I think, on women's rights and, you know, access issues, particularly in Alabama. So it was, I think, trying to be mindful, but really fell short.
Yeah. You mentioned Alabama. Of course, that's where the state Supreme Court ruled that IVF, that embryos were children, you know, and had rights. And that, of course, that has sent the GOP scurrying. How do you see the abortion issue and IVF, all the women's health issues playing out in the coming election in November?
Yeah, well, I think it's real and enduring. I mean, I've worked in politics for over 20 years. Good chunk of that was with Planned Parenthood. So the number of times that I've been mansplained that abortion is not a winning electoral issue, I can't even count. And so there is a part of me that, you know, is relieved that the pressure and the stakes and the broad-based support around access is on full display right now and that we're leveraging it.
I wonder, I want to come back to a couple of GOP women here in California, down in Orange County in particular. We've seen someone like Michelle Steele do really well in a district that doesn't on paper maybe seem like it should be as easy for a Republican to hold on to. And she's pretty conservative, and yet people respond to her differently. I wonder if that's like a flip side of being a woman. Like, can that soften some edges that helps you with voters, even at a time when, you know, the GOP, as you said, is struggling because of Dobbs and other decisions?
Yeah, it could be. I'm not super familiar with her district on the congressional level, but I do think, you know, the research shows that women, even though they face structural disadvantages. They also have superpowers and, you know, that kind of 360-degree network of contacts from raising kids, from, you know, being embedded in community in a way that male candidates are not always. Women are also seen as...
That's such an interesting point. I never thought of that. Like your PTA and all those other, you
list
know,
building.
The soccer.
It's all there. Yep. That's one of the things we talk about in our process with women. But, you know, women are also perceived as more responsive. You know, COVID is a great example, just empathetic, but also practical and solution oriented. So I think for any woman of any partisanship, those tools are in our kit.
There's some benefit there.
So before we let you go, we want to ask you about one of your pets. You have a cat named Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I want to know, first of all, when did you name her? And then do you have any other... you know, pets named after famous Supreme Court justices.
Well, Ruthie is going to be so happy that
you call her Ruthie, not RBG.
She's Ruthie, although as she's approaching her middle age now, and so you know, there's more Ruth in the house. But she was born in 2016, a fateful year, and I think that's the origin story. And you know, we were together the day that our Supreme Court, her namesake, our justice, passed away. So, you know, but she's hanging on. And I do have another secret cat, but he really doesn't like the spotlight as much. He's coming on my Zooms a lot more lately.
Oh, is that right? And you're not going to tell us his name.
I'll protect his privacy.
All right.
He's an introvert.
All right. Susanna Delano from Close the Gap. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you, guys.
And that is a wrap for Tuesday, March 12th. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED.
Our engineer is Sale Muller. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. And I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening.